Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
Mitchie, how are you going?
Good, buddy. That's how are
good,
you?
Good.
It's good to be here again, back in the studio.
No.
Actually, if we tell the truth, we've just recorded a podcast.
We're we
just
do,
about
we
to
do.
Do another. Yes.
Yeah, no, but it's still good to be back here, right?
No, I do like being in the studio.
I'm really excited today because we're starting a new segment again.
Yes.
And this time we're interviewing and having a chat and having a conversation with professionals in their field.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to have Ginger Gorman with us today. Hi, Ginger.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
And I suppose the best way to start is maybe do you want to just tell the story of how you heard about Ginger in the first place?
Yeah. But before we do that, can I just ask you, Ginger, do you have a favourite song?
Oh, I forgot about that.
Do you have a favourite song?
A normal so a song that we have to start our podcast with a song.
We normally do.
I think at the moment the song that my kids have been putting on repeat in the car is Titanium with Sia.
Oh yeah,
because there's a lot going on in our lives, so it makes you kind of feel bulletproof when you listen to it. So
it's such a good song, isn't it?
Siri, when I'm driving along, saying, "Hey Siri, can you play Titanium?" I'm surprised Siri doesn't say, "God, aren't you sick of it by now?"
But,
Can you hum a few bars
I'll
for
help
us?
You out. This is Titanium.
Oh my gosh, I am the worst singer in the world.
That's never stopped Mitch.
But
Ginger,
you know this as well, Milford.
I do know this song. No, you did it beautifully.
But did you know Sia is an Adelaide girl?
Yeah.
And the reason she wears the wig is because she doesn't want to be known.
I think everybody knows that.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying, it is but what an interesting way to get around.
Actually, it's not a bad
segment
thing
into where we're going. That's right. Yeah. That's what I was saying. But she wears a wig so that she doesn't get noticed in media and she's able to live a normal life. But the first time Ginger, it's funny me getting on the other end of this call with you because there's a part of me is nervous about it and there's a part of me is like, you know, inspired because I'm at a place where I'm able to talk about, you know, the reality of what this call is actually means for me. Because even in contacting you the first time, I was so kind of, for the want of a better term, taken back and traumatized by what had happened. And when I read your article in the Marie Claire and what had happened, I felt, you know, this is someone who will understand what has happened for me. And you're a journalist. And I generally, with general journalists, I don't like them because of how we were treated.
And I understand. I really understand.
And for the first time, I was reading an article from a journalist that I was so horrified by what had happened to you. And I was like, I really felt for you. I really felt, Christ, this is horrendous. But how you handled it and how you stepped up into it and how you managed it. And then the fact that another journalist like Marie Claire would come in and how you positioned yourself, because I just wasn't able to do that when it happened to us. You know, I wasn't able to handle it.
Because I think it's interesting to hear about people's stories. Partly what has happened to me since I was trolled and I started writing about trolling is that loads of cyber hate victims contact me. Yeah. And one of the things they say, Mitch, is a little bit like what you're saying now, is I finally felt like I wasn't alone.
Yeah.
Because I think when this stuff happens to you, you feel like you're going bonkers.
Yeah.
And also, it's so extreme. The threats are often so extreme. Yeah. You don't know, is someone actually going to kill my child, or, you know, is someone actually going to burn my house down? You know, so I think oftentimes when you go to the police and so forth, they don't really believe you. So I think when you read a story like that and it's happened to you, you immediately identify with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, I was going to ask you, Ginger, maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about your story, what got you to write the book, what led you to where you're at now, just so that our listeners can have a feel for where you've come from, you know, some of the background.
Yeah, so I never set out to be a cyber hate expert and I'm not techie, right? So I'm not a person that can even really work my phone, My husband's always saying to me, how come you've had this Mac for 5 years? You can't even scroll on it, you know. What happened was, so I've been a journalist for nearly 20 years now, and essentially as a result of something that I had broadcast and written for the ABC, so back in 2010, my family and I became subject of this orchestrated online hate campaign. And when it happened, I was actually on maternity leave. So I had written and broadcast the stuff in 2010, and then this was 3 years later, it all surfaced because these two men I had done these radio stories about turned out to be horrendous paedophiles.
Yeah.
And when that came to light in 2013, so they were arrested, these two men, charged in the United States.
Yeah.
I just became subject of this huge hate campaign. And so I was on maternity leave. I had this brand new baby, and these streams of hate were pouring in.
Mm.
And I just really remember two things so clearly about that time. The first thing was we got this tweet. So we were lying in bed late at night and we got this tweet, my husband and I, saying, your life is over. And I realized that my tweets were geolocated. So you could actually pinpoint our house on Google Maps. And then at a similar time, my husband found a picture of our family on a fascist website that was stolen from his Facebook account.
Wow.
And there was all this disgusting commentary underneath. And then that was really scary because my parents, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. They fled the Holocaust and a number of my family members were killed in the Holocaust.
Right.
So those two things together were just so terrifying. And the thing I remember is just lying in bed and thinking, you know, did I just put my kids' lives in danger because of my job as a journalist?
Mm.
And so that's really where it started, because I had never really in 2013, trolling wasn't a thing that was in the public domain in Australia that much. Mm-hmm. People weren't talking about it. I had certainly never heard of it, and really no one knew what to do. Like, the police didn't know what to do. My ABC bosses didn't know what to do.
Right.
So, yeah, that's where it started.
Right.
Yeah,
because I remember reading, when I read the article in the Marie Claire, and I had seen the previous ABC pieces on these two guys who had obviously gone and got this child out of Russia, and it was horrendous. But I just felt, you know, it's like I felt so much for you and for your kids and your family because of how badly you were targeted. But I also felt like, wow, this is someone who has grabbed this and is now turning it into something extraordinary to help people.
Mm.
Well, I mean, I never will get over it. So Mark Newton and Peter Truong, these men that basically duped me and the rest of the world into thinking that they were these wonderful parents that had this child via surrogacy in Russia, and it turned out, you know, they had purchased him from his Russian mother, and that, in fact, you know, they had shopped him around to paedophiles all over the globe. Like, I will never get over the grief for that child, because I spent quite a lot of time with that child. You know, I was playing in their garden with his chickens. Mm. And I think about him all the time. But I guess what happened, Mitch, is like after about 18 months, I became less scared because the trolling died down a bit. You know, these trolls were saying I was responsible for the crimes against the child and that kind of thing.
Mm.
I mean, which was so, it just was so hard to cope with, knowing that this child had been abused and I'd spent time with him, and then I was somehow being blamed for those crimes. But I suppose I started to see all of my ABC colleagues, a lot of them, especially the women, getting really badly trolled. So death threats, rape threats, beheaded women in their inboxes, like this really vile stuff. And some of them were afraid to go home. And I was seeing really similar things happen in the States to particularly female journalists. It does happen to male journalists a lot as well. Mm-hmm. But the stories I was hearing, and I just wondered, you know, why would you send a threat like that to someone you don't know? Why would you do that? Yeah. Who is the person that's doing that? Because I guess I'm a journalist in my heart, right? So I've got this kind of curiosity, and right. I could see the injustice as well. So it was really kind of that curiosity. But, I mean, my husband, he's a person of colour. He has anxiety. He just said to me, can you just leave it alone? Like, I don't want you to go there. But I actually felt like I couldn't, because I could just see the damage that was happening to people. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
So that was the reason that you really sort of, I suppose, took it up then, was it, Ginger? Because you just felt like it was just making too much damage to other
people?
Yeah,
and I mean, I still feel this now. I felt that really crucial voices were being silenced.
Right.
And that these attacks were so unjustified and so unwarranted, and they were wrecking people's careers. Mm. And I mean, at that point, I did not understand what I was walking into. I can't, you know, I mean, these guys are so dangerous and so violent, you know, like the Christchurch killer was a predator troll.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have done it in the way I did it now. If I, you know, if I knew what I knew now, I wouldn't have done it in that way. But.
Mm.
I then went on to write in the middle of 2017. I'd become a freelance journalist by then, and I wrote this huge series for Fairfax that went viral. It was 4 or 5 parts, and it was published on all the Fairfax papers all over the country and in New Zealand, and a video of Mark, who's one of the predator trolls. And when that happened, just loads of cyber hate targets wrote to me. I mean, they were just streaming into my inboxes, and they were really telling these stories of their destroyed lives, like absolutely destroyed. You know, they'd lost their jobs. They had to move house. They'd had their reputations wrecked. Some of them had to go to court. Some of them had tried to suicide, like just these huge harms.
Yeah.
And that was what prompted me to write the book.
Right.
I, first of all, when I was offered to write the book, I said no, because I thought, you know, I can't put my family through this again. Mm-hmm. I just can't put my kids' lives at risk like that again. But those emails were the thing that made me turn around and say, you know, somebody has to do something. I can't just have all these emails sitting here and knowing that this stuff is happening and no one is addressing it, you know?
Yeah.
Because
the truth about it is, no one was addressing it, you know, and then it's because I think they don't know how to address
it. Well, that's kind of how it was for us, because we had, I mean, our first
I remember when I first read it, right? I just put my name in to Google, And then when I put my name in, this article came up in this Christian forum from this person saying that I had... And they had disguised their name, so they'd had a handle.
Well, it was just a name. It was just a name. It was disguised,
and, you know,
time.
And that I had ruined her life and her children's life, and that. And I read the article, and I remember thinking to myself, the first thing that went on in my mind was, "Christ, have I hurt someone? Have I actually hurt someone? But why has nobody? Why have these kids not come forward? What is going on? What have I hurt this woman? Who is this person? You know, I was so traumatized because I felt what I was doing and my purpose in life was could actually damage someone, and that was so difficult for me to deal with. And then it got worse, and then there was another name. And
well, what happened was, it was like we saw a number of articles pop up within a very short time frame. And they were all by different people. And so all of these different people had written it. And it was like, this is really random.
And it doesn't make
that
sense.
Out of all of, like, out of how long we've been working.
That within like, a short,
that within
period,
a short
of time,
period of time, all of this stuff has come up. And it was just, and we kind of chose at the time not to do anything about it because we didn't know what to do about it.
Well,
right?
Because it's like, I was like a rabbit in the headlights. I was like, what do I do here? What's the step I take?
And what were they accusing you of exactly?
Oh, she had said that her sons had come through and done seminars with us.
Yeah.
And because of the fact, because we do personal development work with people, so what happens is that their perspective of their upbringing had transformed, and they went and spoke to their mum about it, but. What happened actually, Ginger, was I was actually, this is during the middle of all of this, us not knowing exactly what had gone on. I had figured out by one of the
handles.
articles, who one of the people was, because she referenced her children and because of what she'd said about her children. And I thought, well, at least I know who one person is, and maybe, you know. And her son was at a seminar with us one day, and he came up to me and he said, did you see what my mum wrote? And I said, I did actually. And he goes, no. I said, I saw that thing on this
article.
Particular site. And he goes, no. He said, she wrote all of them. So she had gone and disguised her name on a myriad of different sites and had gone and popped this garbage information. So she knew nothing about us, but she was threatened by, I believe, what had happened with her
kids. I think the situation was because the son had then gone and wrote a response, and it turned out, you know, that this, I mean, this poor woman is just a product of her own upbringing. But she was, you know, he was, she'd had seven children to five different men. And, she, you know, in that situation, you know, she was, you know, she'd, these men had physically, emotionally, and there'd been some abuses there. The kids claimed that a lot of this had come at the hands of the mother. And our objective was to get them to you know, to see that, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Every cloud has a silver lining. You know, your mother, no matter what, she did the best that she could and she loves you and you can get on with your life. You don't need to let that past history be, you know, what controls your future. And so we got the kids to get to a point where, well, one of the young lads got to a point, and so did the other one, where they just got clear with their mum, you know, and went home and said, "Mum, look, we love you no matter what. You did an amazing job." But she couldn't handle that, because for her to handle that would mean that then she would have to own the side of her that feels she didn't do an amazing job. And we believe that that was the catalyst for what she did. So she disguised herself as seven different people and then went out and just started trolling and trolling, and it got really out of control.
And then but what happened was we decided not to do it. So where we were coming back to is that when we first saw it, it was like, what do we do? How do we even handle this? Like, we just didn't know. What do we do? So our best course of action at the time, we thought, was just to ignore it. So we just ignored it, and we just thought, you know what? If we just ignore it, it's going to go away and it's not going
to
come back.
And we would, like, we'd speak to some of our mentors and they'd say things was like, don't give it any energy. And it's like, what the fuck does that mean? Don't, you know, this is, I wanted to bang my head against the wall. And because I, you know, I'm a human being and you take it sensitively, you know, and then, but it really drove us to go, okay, we've got to look at what we do and really get better. And
what
better.
Those posts she was writing, did they cause more trolling by other people?
Yes, but from people that had never attended the seminars.
Yes.
So just from when you put it up on a Christian forum, you get all these other Christians come in who are in the US.
So there's so many things going on.
So many
on
layers,
in what you're talking
about.
So first of all, most trolling that happens is, like, it might be triggered by one person. Like in my case, it was triggered by this guy, Robert Stacey McCain. And once he put blog posts on his website, it's almost a green light for people, other trolls, to attack.
Yes.
And sometimes, it might be an article in the media that does it, but it often is like a blog post by someone they like and respect that will then trigger the trolling. Mm. And there's a weird thing that's called the online disinhibition effect. And I think that there's kind of almost a troll in all of us where basically because you can't see the other person, it's almost gamified. So there's no social contract. Mm. So they don't care. Like if they wouldn't say those things in a supermarket or a cafe to
totally,
you.
Yeah.
But because they can't see you, it's almost a game. They get self-righteous and angry really fast and they then attack you.
Mm.
And it's a way of feeling like they're part of this pack. They feel powerful.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes, you know, it's typical gang behavior where people feel weak alone but strong together and sort of self-righteous as well.
Yeah.
But it's terrifying. I mean, it's really terrifying. And the funny thing is as well, like people have these assumptions like, oh, Christians wouldn't do that, or people on the left wouldn't do that, or people in these groups wouldn't do that. I mean, I've seen trolling by women. I've seen trolling by the Greens Party. I've seen trolling by Christians. You know, I've seen trolling by everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I guess the thing is that's difficult is it's almost people say don't read the comments, you know, and the fact of the matter is if it's being said about you, you almost have to read it because, you know, in my book, Troll Hunting, I talked to an internet expert, internet addiction expert, and I said to him, why do you keep clicking when there's this train wreck online and people are saying these terrible things about you that aren't true? And he said there's almost like a feedback loop in our brains and we don't care if it's positive or negative.
That's right.
And if we get on the feedback loop, we just will keep checking, you know. And the way he described it to me was he said, look, Ginger, if you were at a party and someone in a corner was saying stuff about you, you would have to know what it was, whether it was negative or positive, because we're human beings, right? We care about the social standing of ourselves in relation to the group. So it drives me mental that people say, you know, don't read the comments, because I don't actually think that's realistic. I think if someone's talking about you, you're driven to read them because, you know, I mean, this has affected your business, right? So of course you want to know what's happening.
I think the biggest thing for us was that at that point, it was terrible to see that, but because we knew it was one person, it was almost, I don't know,
if somebody got on. What we found was that if somebody got on and realized how one-sided it was, you just had to read it to realize, whoa, whoever wrote this is unstable. You know, there's something not, this is not okay. And so that wasn't so bad. And so it did start to affect the numbers of people that were coming through our events. They would, you know, they'd come on and then they would find this stuff and then come back and talk to us about it. And so we found then that was when we had to do something about it. So we brought in a legal team and eventually we ended up with Stuart Littlemore. I'm sure you've heard of Stuart Littlemore. So we ended up with Stuart in a huge defamation case. But just before our legal team had said, look, we're going to fight this. Just before we were about to come to a point where we were able to put it to rest, the day before that was meant to happen, she took the data and she gave it to the Sunday Times. Now, when that happened, they did not want to know one iota about what had actually happened, who this woman was, what had gone on. They just came after us because we were a bigger medium, we were bigger in our profile, and they just didn't want to know the truth. Like they had no desire to know, you know, recognize the fact that we'd, you know, shared a
stage.
How
long we'd been in business.
How long we'd been doing it, recognized the thousands of people we'd helped, the stages that we'd shared with people like Joe Dispenza, John DeMartini, Jack Canfield, Paul Beck, some of the greatest human development experts in the world had recognized us for the work that we'd done. An Australian company built in Western Australia for processes that were astounding. They did not want to know that. All they wanted was sex and blood and all that sort of stuff. And they, you know, they fought tooth and nail to try to get some sort of witness to come up. The person that they got to come up as a witness, they wouldn't show an image of them because the person was an ex-drug addict, emaciated, had affiliations with bikie gangs, and they got her to give some sort of article, never attended any of her events, did not attend any of her seminars. And because it's the press, it then started to get some validation. So people, you know, the masses read that stuff and it's clickbait, and they think, oh, because if the press is writing about it, then this must be true.
That's when it just all scaled downhill from there. Our staff started getting death threats. Mitch's family,
my family, my children
started getting death threats once all of this.
And you know, I was on a panel with Osman Faruqi. He's from ABC Life, but Andrew Bolt wrote a really extreme column about him at one point, and then Osman ended up getting doxxed. So that's where all your details get put online, and then people start threatening your family, exactly what you're describing, Mitch. Yeah. And I think the thing is that the media often get predator trolled ourselves, like journalists, but the media also triggers predator trolling.
That's right.
So what I mean by predator trolling is where people are using digital devices to do real life harm. So this is like psychological or physical harm or both. And I coined that phrase because if you go down to the police station and say I'm being trolled, they'll just laugh it off, you know, because we have this association with trolling that's like, oh, it's like Scandinavian folklore and it's a little guy on a bridge and he's not going to hurt us. But if this is happening to you, Mitch, where your kids are being threatened and stuff, and you're worried about your physical safety, and you've got a right to be worried, because actually lots of predator trolling spills over into real life. You know, it's really terrifying. But the media needs to take responsibility for the trolling that they cause. You know, a lot of times we're busy saying we're victims, we're victims, we're victims, and we are often victims, you know, like what happened to me is horrendous. Yeah. But also we have a responsibility to write about people in a way that is fair and accountable, because I should not be writing anything that causes your kids to get threatened or you to be threatened, you know.
But would you agree, though, that there's certain media sources that, you know, it's just about clickbait. They really don't care. Like,
of course.
I mean, yeah. Sophie McNeil is my step-niece, and she's an extraordinary journalist in very crazy situations, and she's an amazing kid. But when I was listening to a podcast with Joe Rogan a couple of weeks ago, and he had Rob Zombie on, and Rob Zombie's a great producer out of Hollywood. And Rob was brought a really good point up, and he said, you know, when I started getting trolled, what I did was I looked at who had wrote the articles. And when I looked at who had wrote the articles, I realized, you know what? You have no credibility behind you. If you were somebody that was credible and wrote that article, and you were someone that had some, you know, had done your proper due diligence, then I would be looking at myself going, well, there's got to be some truth in this. And I really sat back and I thought, wow, you know, I've never thought of it like that. But then it did make me go, okay, who did write this stuff? Do they hold? Because if you wouldn't accept their criticism, then why would you accept their advice? You know, it's like,
and I mean, you're absolutely right. And the problem is that at the moment, the media environment, unfortunately, is leaning towards this stuff, because what you have, this isn't an excuse, it's an explanation, because I think the media has a lot to answer for when it comes to predator trolling. Yeah. But you've seen since 2011, you've seen thousands of Australian journalists fired. So you've got a lot less journalists. So they're not doing the quality work that they used to be able to. Right. And then at the same time, you've got increased pressure on those fewer journalists because of the 24-hour news cycle.
Right.
So you've got outfits like the Daily Mail. You know, the Daily Mail is always plagiarizing me, for example. Yeah. Yeah. But they are just absolutely writing the quickest, nastiest, cheapest stuff to get the clicks. And then, you know, of course, it's low quality, it's often plagiarized, it's often untrue, right. And it's triggering predator trolling against people that don't deserve it.
That's right.
It's not fair and balanced investigative reporting. So, you know, there is a kind of crisis in journalism at the moment, and unfortunately it's kind of softening the ground for stuff like this.
Mm.
Can I take us a little bit back and just let's, Ginger, can you give me what you consider your definition of a troll is? Because I know for me, my, you know, I had a kind of a view of what a troll was, but listening to you, I see that you have a more expansive kind of understanding or, what you know, description of what a troll is.
So the word obviously comes from Scandinavian folklore, which is really problematic. So we've all, you know, when we were little, we all used to think about the Billy Goat Scruff, you know,
right.
And this little guy under a bridge, right, and right. He's a bit grumpy, but he doesn't really do us any harm. And so that is a really problematic starting place, because what it means is that we don't, in our heads, we think it's virtual. It's not really going to hurt us in real life. And I guess once I was trolled myself and I started investigating this, and I was like, holy hell, because, you know, like my book links predator trolling to murder, to terrorism, to domestic violence, to assault, to real life stalking, to job loss, like the harms go on and on and on. So what I realized when I was writing the book is that this is actually a spectrum of behavior. It's not one thing. And so at the extreme end, we have hate crimes, and I call that predator trolling,
right.
You know, where people are doing real life harm. And so that's what happened to you guys, where you are getting death threats and so forth, and you're worried for your safety. That is actually affecting you and your business. It's having economic harm. Mm-hmm. So that's predator trolling. But right down the other end, you've got just mild pranks, which are funny and often hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what a Rickroll is?
No.
Have you guys heard of that? So this is where you think it's one of the oldest forms of trolling. So you think you're perhaps investigating something serious, you're researching something, and you accidentally click on Rick Astley's 1987 song, Never Gonna Give You Up. Yeah. Do you know that?
Yes.
So it's called a Rickroll. It's hilarious. It's happened to me. It's like the White House has even done Rickrolls. And it's silly and it's fun and it's absolutely harmless. It's just hilarious.
Yeah.
So then you have some types of trolling which are political, or they might have a social sort of aspect to them, and they're not necessarily harmful, but they make a point. And then you get into this more serious sort of hate speech and verbal attacks, and then you have these hate crimes. So I think we need to be clear in our heads that this is a spectrum of behavior, and at one end it's just silly and ridiculous, but at the other end it's horrific. Very, very dangerous.
So you talk about it's not just somebody it can be, because it can affect everybody, right? It doesn't have to be just because you're a business. It can be there's a lot of DV examples of trolling.
That's
give me an example of that, like.
So predator trolling, where people are doing real life harm by the internet, it bleeds into all these areas. And one of the things I realized, because I've done so much reporting on domestic violence, they call it tech abuse in the DV sector, but in fact it's predator trolling. So it's where someone's ex-partner, oftentimes they were women, but I imagine that happens in reverse as well, the ex-partner is really ruining the person's life via the internet. And so, for example, one woman in my book, she's called Justine. That's not her real name, but she had a really violent ex-partner. And when she finally got away from him, she moved back to her small town, and he just went about absolutely destroying her reputation and any ability she had to get a job or feel safe online. And in the end, all these people that she knew, they turned against her and were sort of stalking her as well, incited by the ex-partner online and criticizing her constantly. And she found it very hard to live in that town, and in fact tried to suicide a couple of times because she just wasn't safe anywhere, and she just felt so attacked and demeaned constantly by this man. You know, she said to me, I haven't been with him for 10 years and he's still destroying my life. Right. So it is a huge problem in domestic violence situations. Mm. Yeah, it's not. And the interesting thing is, like, you know, in the DV sector, they talk about coercive control. But in fact, Mitch and Amelia, what's happened to you is, like, it's also coercive control. The trolls are still trying to use those same tactics, whether they know you or not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a really scary behavior. And I think people need to really understand that this stuff doesn't stay online. Like, once people are losing their jobs, or it's having an economic impact, or it's having, you know, real health impacts.
Yeah.
So, what I did. So one of the things I realized, and you know, it's clear in both your stories as well, is that this kind of behavior has a huge economic cost.
Yeah.
So people were telling me about all kinds of ways that it was costing them money. Like, you're talking about going to court, right? Yeah. That would have cost you a lot of money.
$400,000.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. So then you've think about all the people that didn't come to your seminars.
That's right.
Think about all the other ways. Perhaps you've had to go get medication because you were so stressed, or you've had to see your doctor, or you've taken time off work. So people were describing these things to me. And at one point, one woman in particular, she's called Carmen in my book, she told me, you know, this has cost me at least, you know, $250,000. And I thought, if I could get the money, if I could tell people how much does this cost the economy, people would listen to me. Because at the moment, you know, before I wrote the book, people just would say, don't be a snowflake, pull your big girl panties up, block and delete. They did not understand the impact. So I started ringing all these economists, kind of saying, can you help me? And most of them was sort of say, what's Twitter? What's Facebook? You know, they'd try to hang up the phone on me, and I think they thought I was, you know, bonkers. But then Richard Dennis from the Australian Institute, he's an economist, but he's a real visionary. And so he said to me, we'll help you get this data, Ginger. This sounds really important. So I commissioned the Australian Institute, which is not a normal thing for a journalist. We don't go and pay people to do surveys for us.
Yeah.
But I commissioned the Australian Institute on my own money. They gave me this bargain basement price, and they did this nationally representative polling, and we found that 44% of Australian women and 34% of Australian men have experienced online harassment. Which is 8.8 million Australians. And 1.3 million Australians have experienced extreme predator trolling.
Wow.
And I would count you both in that category.
Wow.
And then it costs $3.7 billion to the economy. So it's, and that is just, that $3.7 billion that we come up with, that was just time off work and lost income. So it was just, sorry, it was just, hang on, it was just lost income and medical expenses.
Right.
So it's only those two things.
Wow.
So if you think about all the other things, that's like right. the court costs and you know, the moving house and the childcare and the police costs and all those other things, it would be a lot more than that.
And, you know, the funny thing was when we, like, it didn't just cost me that, it also cost her that. And, you know, this woman was in her 60s and, you know, obviously, you know, she was at a point that I don't even think she'd been working, but, you know, she jumped in with a lawyer and the lawyer egged her on to fight this, you know, when she never had a case, like she never had a case, you know, and we had it thrown out within about an hour and a half. Stuart Littlemore had the whole thing, verdict in her favour, whole thing thrown out, but all the damage had been done. You know, it was all over, you know, it was nothing we could do about it, even getting it down. She was given a court order, you must get it down. And she had set it up in such a way that you can't take it down because it was set up in sites in the US where they didn't recognise Australian law. And so, you're like, nobody won at the end of this, you know, and a lot of the time, even my staff say to me, God, you didn't handle it the right way. You handled it badly. And I'm like, well, I don't know how I was meant to handle it. You know, I felt all I know is that the immediate things that went on for me was I felt for her. I felt, oh my God, is this woman okay? I felt compassion for her. I felt empathy for her. I felt like, you know, our objective is for you to see that you're an extraordinary woman, no matter what you went through. You know, your children love you. You're a great human being. And that is the premise of what we do. And my certainty about what we do is much greater than anybody's doubt. I'm, you know, this is what we do. We help people to get over stuff and get on with their lives, really do it, you know? And so the empathy and compassion I felt for her, at the end of it, you know, I know that this lawyer egging her on, telling her she could do it and she was going to win. And when we got in there, they were like, they were novices. They just got tore a complete new one. At the end of it, I felt further for her that she got dragged down that legal hole because she just, all she had to do was take it down.
So are you saying that you're saying that the effects of the trolling are just as, like, as much as it's for you, that she's got those ramifications in some way as well.
Totally. Right. Because these guys
I mean, it's really interesting that you have had that response, Mitch, and I admire you for it because one of the things that I did with my book is I tried to go in and talk to the trolls. I didn't know it had a name, but after people read the book, they started writing to me saying you had radical empathy for them.
Yeah.
You know, you had this kind of unconditional positive regard. And because I wasn't trying to be a journalist, really. I was trying to understand. I was trying to put all that garbage aside and try to understand, like, who are you and why would you do this? And actually, I mean, a lot of what you're saying about this woman rings true. Like the trolls in my book, they were all young white men. So there are a specific cohort of trolls and there are different kinds of trolls, but these were mainly right wing, very, very damaged young men.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they come from terrible backgrounds, neglected, harmed, abused backgrounds, a lot of violence, a lot of drugs, all those things. Mm. And, you know, these guys, I mean, I don't know this woman, obviously, but these guys were completely left alone and unparented from the time of 10 or 11, like just left on the internet, you know, imbibing being white supremacy, misogyny, all these different kinds of hatred. And you know, I'm not amazed that they are spat out later as the Christchurch killer.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, people who behave in these ways, they don't do that by accident. They are carrying a lot of rage and a lot of harm and a lot of damage. And you know, one of the things I keep saying when I talk about the guys in my book is like, these are our children. These children are in our community. And if we don't help them at this age when they're getting radicalized into this stuff, they will go and harm other people. So, you know, I mean, it's, I wonder, I would love to know what this woman's background is, like how she got to that place, because I don't think if you have a high self-regard and you feel good about your life, you end up doing those things, you know?
Yeah. And I think that we're all a byproduct of our history. And, but I think it gave her some validation, and it allowed her to feel like she was fighting for something morally and ethically right, as much as that was completely delusional based on the fact that she was lying. And if you're morally and ethically right, well, then you'll say who you are. You'll say your name. You won't be afraid to do that. You won't create false, you know, handles. You won't do that sort of stuff. But what I'm finding now as well is that in terms of, it seems to be that the information that is going out online, you know, people are not believing it as much anymore. And it seems like people are not believing the media anymore. You know, people are starting to realize, you know, this, you're controlling how I feel when I wake up in the morning and look at a headline. And you're making me mad and angry by something that's history that I can do nothing about, and it's lopsided and it's non-substantiated and it's completely misinforming, and you're controlling how I feel and moderating me without having to be there. You know, making me be pissed off with a colour, a race, a creed, a type of sexuality without me knowing anything. So you're keeping me ignorant. And it seems that, I don't know whether you're seeing this, but it seems that with the demographic that we're working with, people are definitely waking up to that stuff. You know, definitely waking up to this nonsense.
I mean, journalism isn't doing itself any favours because, look, there's quality. What's interesting since, say, Donald Trump came into office in the US is he's constantly attacking the media and undermining the media's credibility. And as we've discussed, like, the media does, in various sections of the media, do a fine job of that on their own. However, I think there's a real difference between quality journalism and other kinds of journalism. Like what we've seen since Donald Trump got into office, for example, is like subscriptions to the New York Times and the Washington Post. So these quality outlets are going up.
Yes.
So what we in fact need is more resources put into those quality kinds of journalism. But I also think journalism itself and the tenets of journalism, and I talk about this quite a lot in my book too, like, needs a shake-up. So we need to be more honest about how we report, what we do with people's quotes.
Yes.
You know, how did we get the story? Is this all sides of the story, fact?
Yeah.
You know, be more transparent about what is a journalist, who gets to call themselves a good journalist, how do you go about your craft? Because, you know, I broke all the rules of journalism in my book, and actually I think it's a better book because I did that.
Oh, wow.
You know, but a lot of journalists don't agree with it. So journalism is in a crisis right now.
Yeah. I mean, but where would we agree? Where would we be if we all agreed with each other? You know,
and that's a huge point. Like I say at every time I speak about tolling, I say, when did we lose the ability to disagree? Like, why do you need everybody to be the same as you? Why do you need people to agree with you? Yeah. You know, also don't threaten to kill my kids if you don't agree with me, you know?
Yeah, there's something I've also noticed as well. I've been speaking about it. I started talking about it about 12 months ago. You'll remember this, Mills, where I was watching what was happening. You know, Facebook were getting dragged across the coals for, you know, manipulating data, controlling how people felt. And then there's this big push in the world. You know, we got to stop drinking Coca-Cola. We got to stop drinking all these drinks, and we got to change the world. But, you know, it's supply and demand. If the demand is there, then the supply turns up. And so I just find that, you know, because young people wake up in the morning and adults do as well, and they switch on their Facebook feed and they just start trolling, or they start scrolling. And as they're scrolling, they start clicking on things, and whatever you click on, they will feed you more of, you know. Mm. And I've said to some of our clients, guys, if you want your world to change, like if you're switching on your Facebook feed and you're getting North Korea, Donald Trump, blah, 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 that's because you're clicking on that stuff and you're reading it. And most of it is nonsense. You don't know what's going on. You're never going to know what's going on. And so if you click on more inspiring things, things that empower you and enable you, well, you will get more of that in your feed. So they're only doing what we're doing. If we're watching and reading that stuff, you know, that's making you feel resentful without even having to be there, you have a chance to change that. And the way to change that is to be more awake and aware of and be more be easier on yourself and how you take yourself into the day by reading material that inspires you and empowers you and enlightens you and helps you to grow.
And reading books and things, yeah. You know, like it's been actually really hard because of my job. I have to be on all those channels and actually try to stop looking at my phone for an hour or two. Like I love reading, but I actually find I'm almost addicted, you know, and so it's actually really hard to put it aside and read a book for an hour. But I think as well, you know, the social media companies have a massive case to answer here. Mm. Like they have created these platforms where we are coming to grave harm and, you know, they are nation states. They have more users than China and India put together. Mm. They, you know, make billions of dollars from our data. They pay almost no tax, and yet they have no duty of care to the public.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are really interesting questions. Like, can you imagine a car company putting cars on the roads with no seatbelts and we didn't care that people were getting killed in the cars? Right. No. You know, the companies that made those cars would be regulated, otherwise they couldn't make the cars. So it is quite baffling to me that governments around the world have just let this slide. I mean, we are, you know, we are seeing some regulation in places like Germany now. They are regulating this stuff. But yeah, so Germany brought in a really interesting law that kind of went too far almost. It's got one of those German names that has 1,000 letters, but it's like they call it, I think it's ZDNetz is the short version of it. And it basically fines these companies 50 million euros per hateful post if they don't take it down in 24 hours.
Wow.
So they are taking it down. They are. Wow. So you know, there's some critiques of that law. They say it's cooling free speech and things, but I think it does show that governments can take decisive action if they want to. That's I think is interesting about it. So, you know, the social media companies, though, are just like missing in action. They've been talking about fixing this since 2006 and they're not really doing anything much.
I think that, you know, based on what I've heard, you know, with you speaking, Ginger, it's very much, you know, the rules that we live by in our physical reality are not translated online. And the things that, you know, I wouldn't be able to go up, like it's not freedom of speech. You know, I heard you say this before, it's not freedom of speech because I can't go up to somebody in the street and just say what I want because I could be, you know, charged for harassment or whatever. So if I can't do that in a physical realm, just to be able to translate that into the online realm is important. And we're like,
absolutely. Like, people get hysterical about censorship on the internet. And I think that's ridiculous because exactly what you're saying, nobody has absolute free speech. And you shouldn't have, because where your speech harms me is where your free speech has to end, you know? And there's kind of decades of research that show that if you dehumanize people with speech, then, you know, others are more likely to harm them in real life. So speech on the internet can have really harmful effects. We've seen it. It's documented in my book, like, you know, the Daily Stormer troll army incited these riots and then a woman was killed. It's fairly clear. So, yes, free speech, your speech should be limited when it hurts other people, whether it's offline or online. You know, to me it makes no difference at all.
I want to comment something that I say often to people, and you know, they see things online, and this is going to come to you hopefully answering how you think we should be responding to these trolls. What I don't like specifically is when somebody's saying something hateful, that people come down come in on the comments or wherever, and they are just as hateful in return, because I feel that that's just perpetuating the same problem. There has to be a better way, because there has to be a better way to respond to what's going on. How do you recommend that people go and respond?
So this is really challenging, right? Because I don't think it should be up to victims. I don't think, you know, people always come to me and say, what should I do? What should I do? And my response is, well, really, like, we wouldn't say to a domestic violence victim, it's your fault that you got attacked, you have to fix it. So we need to be really conscious of not victim blaming, I think, is the first thing. Like, don't blame the person that's being attacked. Mm-hmm. One of the most powerful things I have realized is about bystanders. So this is just like what we teach kids in the playground, that if someone is being attacked, don't just be a bystander, be an upstander. So what I've started doing, which works, it's actually quite amazing, is what I do is I do a call out to help someone who is being attacked. So, for example, if you, Amelia, were being attacked, I would start my call out on Twitter by saying, please help, because people are much more likely online if you give a really clear direction. They're more likely to respond. Then I would explain what's going on, you know, that unfair lies were being spread about you. They're completely untrue and now you're being attacked. And then I would say, please amplify her voice. So make you bigger. So retweet you, write positive comments underneath. And then I say, I don't believe in being silent to the trolls, because it silences people. So then I say, the third thing I say is, if you're going to talk back to the trolls, stay calm and be polite and be corrective. Mm-hmm. So correct any mistakes. And what happens when you do that is actually you get a crowd of people supporting you and they make your voice bigger. Mm-hmm. And A, you don't feel alone, and B, you kind of, the trolls don't like it when you have a massive posse supporting you. Right. What they want is for you to be weak and alone.
Right.
And
right.
So you find with that stuff that actually it dies down.
Right.
The other thing you can do is enforce social norms. So, you can go in there and tell people that their behavior is bad. So I often do that. I'll often say, I saw someone attacking Lisa Miller. She's a journalist on ABC News 24. She's a lovely person, and she's now permanently presenting the breakfast program, but she was just filling in. And this guy was just saying this foul stuff to her, like, you stupid bitch, you talk shit for hours. And it was just revolting. And I just went in there and said, hey, Philip, like, I just wonder if you would say that to Lisa if you met her in the supermarket in real life. She's actually a really lovely, hardworking person. And he actually stopped it. Oh. And I think, you know, if people enforce social norms and enforce, you know, normal human politeness, sometimes people pull their heads in because they realize, like, oh, this isn't actually an acceptable behavior.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a few other things people can do themselves, but I always give a caveat, like, the victim isn't to blame.
Yeah.
Like, I think what you're doing now is amazing for both yourselves and your audience, because forewarned is kind of forearmed, so people need to get their psychological armor on and know that this stuff is out there. I think that's helpful, just because when it happens to you, like what you guys describe was just being totally sideswiped, which is what happened to me.
Yeah.
So part of that, and then just I always say to people, if it happens to you, step away from the internet for a while if your mental health is being affected, and reach out to your real life support network. So, you know, talk to your community, and then obviously, like, use those buttons on those platforms, like block, mute, all those things, and report.
So
report to the platform, report to the police, report to eSafety. Australia is the only country in the world that has a statutory office designed to protect its citizens online, and that is esafety.gov.au. And they can often help you. They'll often help you get stuff taken down. They are in contact with the police, in contact with the platforms, and there's loads of resources for parents, for women, like all kinds of resources that can help you with this stuff.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to ask is I've noticed certain people responding and reaching out to people who've trolled them, and I know you've done something similar, but I think I saw it was it Sarah Silverman? I think somebody had called her a cunt.
Yes, I saw that.
And then she responded and actually got a dialogue happening and didn't I totally get your point about the victim blaming and that it's not the victim's responsibility necessarily, but I really quite like that response, and I like the fact that you you reached out to or you reach out to your trolls, and I know you've befriended one of them in particular, and created a dialogue amongst the two of you. Can you speak a little bit to that?
I mean, look, it is hard because if you're being attacked and you feel really vulnerable, especially if you're scared for your safety, you know, that's not necessarily always a great option. I mean, what I say to people is just you need to follow your instincts, right? So I'm not here to tell anyone you should be silent to them or you shouldn't be silent to them. Yeah. You need to do what's right for you in that moment. And so, Mitch, when people say to you, you handled it wrongly, there isn't really a right way to handle this. But, I mean, if you want to and you feel strong, it can sometimes even be a fun thing to do. Like sometimes I'll say to them, do you need a hug, or, you know, just trying to disarm them a little bit because they're being so vitriolic. And at the stage I'm at, sometimes they almost think it's funny. I start laughing. So, cool. You can if you feel like you want to, you know. And, yes, I mean, people write to me and say, how could you engage with the perpetrators in this way? Like, but actually, you know, a lot of the guys that were trolling the white supremacists in my book, they feel marginalized. So they were actually delighted to have the opportunity to explain their lives and explain where they're coming from. And, you know, some of them, like, there's a story in my book that I talk about a lot. There's a story that isn't in my book that I talk about a lot because this troll would not let me put it in there. It's the only thing that any of them said you can't put in the book. And this guy was an incel when I met him. So he was like one of those involuntary celibates that have been in the news lately. They call themselves incels and they hate women. They're really misogynistic. They believe you should, you know, use violence to get sex from women, and the chat logs are just like nauseating. Like I mean, the stuff I've read from the incels is just so disgusting. I mean, that's partly why I got PTSD from writing the book. But this guy, I talked to him for about a year, and it wasn't like anything special. It was just normal human contact. He was talking to me on the apps all the time because these guys never shut up once I made contact with them, you know. And then, like, after about a year, he said, just said to me, thank you so much, Ginger, because I no longer hate women.
Wow.
And he did tell me that he'd started dating a woman, and I thought sort of like, oh, lucky her, you know. but actually, like, I just thought, you know, this is a story about humanity. Like, this is what happens if you show normal human kindness over a period of time to someone who's never experienced it, you know. I don't have all the answers to cyber hate, but I think that there's a seed of an answer there, because all that was just normal human kindness, which I don't think that this kid had ever been shown before by anybody.
I will just finish up there in a minute, but I just want to say, you know, the book is Troll Hunting, and you know, I hope that one day we will look back on this time in life and in society and see that it's no longer in our society, and that we are able to just, you know, love one another and rise above it and show empathy and care and compassion to disarm these humans because I think that that's really ultimately what they need. You know, they're products of their upbringing, and it's tough for them, you know, and we have to show love and care and empathy. And you know, for me, I just think that love is the only way around any of it.
And for us, it's about starting with yourself and doing what's right for you and then leading that on. Yeah. Can I finish up with two quick questions, Ginger, and they can take 30 seconds to answer. The first one is, what would your one piece of advice be to anybody who's dealing with anything like this? What would be your one piece of advice?
The trolls don't know you. You know, they don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. And to them, attacking you is business. So they are often just looking for your weakest point and taking pleasure in hurting you. Mm. So I think if you know that, that is a great weapon, because the things that they say and do often stop hurting you. Mm. I think it's a really strong piece of psychological armor.
Yeah.
Because you feel like it's personal, but in fact it isn't. Mm. And once one of the trolls said that to me, I actually felt really strong. So, you know, they can say to me all sorts of things now, and it just almost doesn't even touch the sides.
The second question is, if out of everything that's happened, what's the one thing that you're the most grateful for?
Well, I don't know if this quite answers your question, but one journalist said to me, have you lost your faith in humanity? And I said, no, I've actually lost my faith in journalism. I'm actually, you know what I'm grateful for? Particularly the troll that I became friends with. His name is Meepsheep. And look, it's probably the hardest relationship I've ever had in my life, because when I met him, he was kind of fairly misogynist, Trump-loving, kind of gun-loving, outright president of this trolling syndicate. But he actually really gave me a go. Like, despite all the terrible things that had happened to him in his life, he was willing to talk to me in this quite open-hearted and honest way. And I formed a relationship with him that is like no other relationship I've had. It's so difficult. It's such a hard relationship. But I learned things about myself and about the world I couldn't have learned any other way. So I think I'm actually really grateful for humanity and grateful that there's more that connects us than drives us apart. And in the end, if you want to find those connections with people, you can. But you need to kind of have courage in them. I mean, people say to me, oh, you're so amazing to build that relationship with him. And I say to them, no, he's amazing to build that relationship with me, because he had the most devastating, damaged upbringing, and he gave me that chance. It's my job to listen to people. I'm a journalist. He didn't have to be open-hearted in that way. So, it was a terrible experience. It nearly destroyed me, but I'm still very grateful for it. Mm.
Ginger, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Yeah. I think that was a great way to end.
Ginger, the article that I read in Marie Claire just made such a huge difference. Thanks for your courage and your tenacity and for not giving up. And thank you.
And thank you for having me. I'm sorry for what you went through, but I really appreciate the time you've given to the topic, and I hope we're all going to help make the internet safer now.
Thanks,
thanks,
buddy.
So much.
Thank you. Bye. Ciao, ciao. Bye.
If you found this information inspiring, make sure you subscribe and tune in to the next Dorothy and the Dealer podcast.